Our reading this morning comes from The Painted Desert by Lewis Edrich. Life will break you. No one can protect you from that, and living alone won't either. For solitude will also break you with its yearning. You have to love. You have to feel. It is the reasons you are here on this earth. You are here to risk your heart. You are here to be swallowed up. And when it happens that you are broken or betrayed or left or hurt or death brushes near, let yourself sit by an apple tree and listen to the apples falling all around you in heaps, wasting their sweetness. Tell yourself you tasted as many as you could.
Perhaps it is predictable that my favorite part of the Jesus story is the moment that many Orthodox preachers would call his moment of temptation. It's near the end of his life when Jesus begins to realize that things are not going to end well. He's in the garden known as Gethsemane, with his friends all around him, although they were sleeping. Jesus is angry and afraid. So he starts praying. He prays, in this case, that prayer of help. He's praying that something else, anything else, could happen instead of what he realized then was going to happen. He prays that he won't have to die, that there could be a different ending. After all, I imagine he had plans. He had these friends that he loved, and he still had more he needed to do to make the world right, more to make right the human heart. It was too soon. Please, he prayed, let my story be different. Now, anyone who is attached to Jesus as God, and God as all-knowing and all-powerful, would find this moment problematic, to say the least. Right? Because if Jesus is God, and God is all-powerful and all-knowing, and then he's praying and pleading, yet doesn't seem to have the power to make that change happen, it's a little problematic. But for those of us who focus on Jesus as a human being or who have other understandings of God, this moment feels just right and familiar. After all, most of us know this moment, this experience too well. This experience where the story we thought we were living in, or the family or career we thought we were building, or the nation we thought we were a part of. When our sense of any of these or of life on the whole reveals itself as faulty or fragile, as if our whole world has been built on a house of cards that's about to come tumbling down, we all know that instinct to fall to our knees begging that everything could just be different, just be okay. This is what Jesus was doing in the garden. Realizing that it wasn't, that it wouldn't ever be okay. He wouldn't survive to experience the glory that he'd been fighting for. The overturning of the powers of injustice. In his helplessness, he cried out in shock and despair and gave voice to that brokenheartedness that we all can relate to, expressing a grief for what was, a grief for what never would be. And along the way, he cried out as a plea that somehow his brain and his heart could catch up to this new dawning reality that he was facing before he missed even the few moments he still had left. Now, for most of us, this reconciling and recreating work of letting go of one way we thought life was headed and then accepting a whole other reality is slow and difficult, often painful work. It requires a lot of friends and therapy. determined attention, a great discipline of time and effort, and ideally some sort of spiritual practice along the way that can help us connect to that greater sense of truth, capital T, even while our personal sense of truth, small t, has fallen apart. This process takes a lot of time and effort because along the way, actual brain rewiring needs to happen. I mean, literally, new synapses and nodes must be built in order for the brain to truly make sense of that new world. The brain has its own internal sense of reality that helps us navigate these external notions, these external realities. And so when this moment happens, our brain has to rewire. I find it relentlessly reassuring to know that this neurobiological process can take up to 3 years. So you're not just being stubborn. 3 years after a big loss or other major life change, even when it's something we think of as positive, like a new baby or a new marriage, it can take 3 years for the brain to build those new nodes, to reconcile life as we previously thought it was, and then what now we realize it is. By which I mean to say, be patient with yourself. It's okay to not have it all figured out yet. It's okay to catch yourself still thinking for a moment the old way is still true, even though you know better. It's okay. 3 years. It's biological. Of course, try telling that 3 years to the 24-hour news cycle or your social media feed, I know. In our world today, it can feel like a new reality is placed in front of us to try to make sense of and incorporate multiple times every day. Stuff that readily would require multiple years to try to make sense of and come to terms with. Instead, we're given like multiple hours. Which is one of the reasons back in January and in our practice circles, we've been encouraging taking up the practice of Sabbath. Because in the midst of all these constant new stories and changed worlds, we need time to just let things process. To try to come to terms with it all. Sort it out and sort ourselves out without that constant additional input to try to integrate. This Sabbath practice was exactly what Jesus' closest friends were attempting the day after his death. After he died, there was a long night, and then a long day, and then another long night. I imagine them all in their homes trying to make sense of what had just happened, trying to reconcile this their experience of the past, this teacher, his promises, their dreams, what they were doing together, and now this future just gone, something new. Still trying to come into this present. After the Sabbath, Mary Magdalene goes first to the tomb. Some accounts say she went first by herself. Others make her one of a few women who go. While it was still dark, she or they came bearing spices that they might perform the ritual tasks for their friend. These motions that we say are for the dead, but actually are to do the work on the living, helping us as we tend to our loved ones, to accept the new reality, to build those new connections. Mary Magdalene had loved him. Her life had been changed by him. He was gone. He was different. He could fix things, fix people, overthrow the forces of injustice, instill the ways of peace. He was gone. They had all these plans, the things they would do together, become together. He was gone. I've been trying to imagine when and how Mary Magdalene first realized what Jesus knew in the garden, that he was to die, Who told her, and how did she respond? Did she bargain? Did she deny? No way. Or did somehow she see it coming? Was she strangely serene and accepting? I mean, after all, she did know what about life not going according to plan. The others, the men, they could go back to their old life. They could go back and be fishermen once again. But what was she going to do? She could not go back. Could not go back to who she was. She was a new person already, no matter what. So she came with her spices. But by the time she arrived, the tomb, it was empty. Her friend's body, it was not there. She figured it had been stolen, another indignity. So she calls her friends, the male disciples, and they do come, but they just run away after they confirm the tomb is empty. Mary stays, still weeping, wondering, what's going on? What reality her brain should try to build the connections around, even. And then Jesus himself appears. Mary. Instinctively, she tries to embrace him, and he says, no, don't cling to me. He pulls away. I mean, her brain must have been a total mess. And her heart, filled with confusion and joy and fear and shock. Or at least this is the way it goes in the Gospel of John. According to another version, the Gospel of Mark, when they arrive at the empty tomb, in this case it's Mary and two other women, they meet a young man who tells them that Jesus is no longer there, that he'd been raised. And then he tells them to go tell Peter and the other disciples. Mary and the two other women, they freak out. In this version, and they run away and they say nothing to anyone. And that's the end of the Gospel of Mark. It's my favorite gospel. See, Mark was the first gospel to be written, and even then it was about 70 years after Jesus had died. By then, you can imagine lots of synapses have been formed, lots of connectors, generations of telling and retelling this story, of trying to pull the pieces together, so much so that the story had begun to take on a life of its own. And yet still it takes until the Gospel of John, written 30 years after that, to have an attempt at trying to say what all of this even meant. Now I've heard people use the Gospels differences, the different accounts, and their late authorship to dismiss these stories, saying that so much time and these variances must mean that they are clearly fictional. But this suspicion misunderstands these stories and their intent. The Bible is not journalism, after all. It's not intended to be one in a cycle of your 24-hour news feed. It's better understood as what religious scholars call kerygma, or proclamation. These stories and their authors, they're hoping to proclaim a core truth that was passed on across generations. So many years later, they and we don't know for sure the literal facts of what happened, but we can listen for this core truth they're trying to offer, knowing that there's something here that intends to proclaim a nugget of wisdom, this good news that somehow survived through it all, this gem of truth that was passed on age to age, now over 2,000 years later. Which brings me back to the moment in the garden with his friends sleeping around him and Jesus yearning for life to somehow be different. Because by the time we get to John, 100 years later, Jesus doesn't pray for a different story. not there in that version. Instead, he wonders for a moment if he should ask for something else. But then he answers himself, "No, I have come for this. I have come to love, to feel. It is the reason I am here on earth, to love, to taste all I can, to offer myself extravagantly." In the middle of our mixed up world, where so often we don't know which reality to believe, where too often we too long for a different ending, these stories of Easter offer us still a dual affirmation that indeed it's true, life will break you, break us. For all the many ways this story gets retold, no one has ever tried to erase this part. Good Friday comes every year in every version, asking us to live out this acknowledgement, this painful truth that everything can and will fall to pieces. Not even Jesus could stop it. Because this is what it means to be alive. And sometimes, for a while, we don't know how long, 3 days or 3 hours, 3 years or 3 centuries, this may be all we have. And yet Easter doesn't leave it there, because what Easter also invites is this possibility that this risk of living, this betrayal, need not take away life's sweetness. That even after the worst has happened, this story can keep going. That although sometimes it's true, it's too soon to make sense of it all. All that has happened, and to find reconciliation, it's never too late. That even now, thousands of years and cultures away from that empty tomb, there could still be these still struggling humans, still trying to put the pieces together, still trying to get to the truth of it all, still trying to be a part of life's recreation and resurrection. So that even as we fall to our knees, wishing that we too could be relieved of life's pain, we will answer ourselves, "No, I have come for this. To love, to feel, to risk my heart, to taste all the sweetness, and to let none of it go to waste." May it be so. Amen. And happy Easter.